Welcome to the Debate at GO8 podcast series exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and, by extension, Australia's economy and our society. Today, we're catching up with a leading specialist with more than 30 years' experience in the defence, national security and the information and communications technology sectors. Dr. Sanjay Mazumdar was appointed the Executive Director of the Defence Trailblazer in October last year. The Defence Trailblazer is a $250 million enterprise aimed at strengthening the collaboration between defence, academia and industry, while also accelerating research and commercialisation. It's powered by the University of Adelaide and the University of New South Wales, with funding from the Australian Government. It's estimated the project will have a net economic benefit to our national economy of $1.5 billion over the next 10 years. My name's Ron Cantlars, I'm a freelance journalist and producer, and throughout this series we've been canvassing a range of topics touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland and Western Australia. With me in the studio is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight universities. Dr. Sanjay Mazumdar, you're a defence industry specialist and an expert in areas of AI and quantum computing. Before we get into the Defence Trailblazer program, let's hear your perspectives on the changing nature of warfare, given what's happening with AI and quantum computing.
Sure. Well, firstly, thank you to both you, Ron and Vicky, for the opportunity today. So defence is really all about information now. So it's about how do we bring together all these different types of information to help try and derive intelligence about what's going on, whether it be our adversaries, whether it be what's going on out in the battle space. And that intelligence then informs the actions you take. So increasingly what people are looking to do is generate that intelligence using lots and lots and lots of different data from lots and different sensors, and then rapidly in real time turn that into actionable insights. So in order to do that, you actually need to support the human. So you need to support them through the use of AI, the use of autonomy, and sort of look for that sort of needle in that data haystack. So what is that adversary doing? What are they planning? Where are they planning it? And so AI is going to become an increasingly important part of the defence landscape, particularly in support of what we want to do around using information. The other bit where AI, I think, is going to have a real game-changing impact is around autonomy. So increasingly, you know, we're investing in autonomous platforms, whether it be, you know, UAVs in the air or UUVs underwater. The brains of the autonomy is really AI. So it's able to detect objects and work out what that object is and whether it should travel toward that object. It's about being able to coordinate with other UAVs or UUVs to work out, as a swarm, to work out how they should operate, etc. So autonomy is driven by AI. So AI has an increasingly important part. Now, the where quantum comes into it is increasingly we're trying to crunch a lot more numbers, a lot more data, you know, imagery, etc. And at some point in time, current computing technologies won't be able to cope with it in the time frame we need in the defence environment. And so this is where quantum computing offers great hope. The ability to really crunch through lots and lots of data to really inform that the intelligence and the insights that then inform.
Can you give us an example of that in the battle space? You talk about unmanned vehicles, you know, operating, etc., and all of this information coming via computers, a lot of visual information. Can you give me an example of how quantum computing will resolve some of this for the general out there in the field?
Yeah, absolutely. So you talked about visual imagery, and that's perhaps one of the areas where it's going to be most applicable. So a lot of what's informing the decision-making that people make is through things like satellite imagery, right? And so satellite imagery is very intensive, right? It's intensive to generate, it's intensive to process, it's intensive to transmit. And so the ability that quantum computing offers is the ability to process that satellite imagery in real time, so that you can then work out, well, what is that buildup of activity over here? Is it an adversary building up a military outpost, etc.? And so you can do it now through current computing techniques, but you can do it far quicker, far greater accuracy in real time with the advent of quantum computing.
Forgive me for the Hollywood sort of depiction of these things, but sometimes you see these things where, you know, Hollywood makes everything so simple. They just touch the screen, open it up, zoom into, you know, a battlefield site, get instant information and detailed pictures. Is that the sort of stuff
you're
talking about?
Send in a drone.
Yeah, send in a drone.
So, Hollywood is often a few years ahead of where reality is. And so that, I guess, is where we want to get to.
Yep.
And so we can do some of that now, and we can do a lot of that now, but the problem is that the amount of data we want to process now is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And if you think about, often I sort of a bit disparagingly say, you know, often these, you know, new aircraft, these new ships, these new new land vehicles are really, you know, flying or floating sensors, and they're just hoovering up lots and lots of data. And so as a commander in an ops center, you're being inundated with data. And so the ability to process all of that and turn it into actionable insights is getting harder. And this is where quantum is going to be of, you know, massive benefit. Mm.
So Australia's not the only country that is kind of doing this work around quantum and AI and robotics and hypersonics, et cetera. Where do we sit in the landscape? Because it really is a technological race, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
And so I guess a double-barreled question from your observations, where do we sit and do we have the upcoming expertise to support the development of that research and technology?
Yeah. So I think in terms of those two areas specifically, we have a lot of strength. So if I pick AI, and we're here in Adelaide, and so Adelaide has the Australian Institute of Machine Learning, you know, it's number 2, 3, 4 in the world in terms of computer vision, which is a form of AI, machine learning. So from a research strength perspective, fantastic capability. The challenge we have is, how do you scale that? How do you scale it when you don't have the deep pockets that you have overseas, right? So you've got commercial companies and governments putting in billions of dollars into these areas. And so the challenge we have is, how do you take that really deep expertise we've got and scale it globally?
So do you have ideas around that? I mean, how do we?
Well, I think that this leads to, you know, what we're trying to achieve with the Trailblazer, which is all about, how do we translate some of this, you know, deep tech into industry and then try and commercialize that to grow the companies of tomorrow, and through the growing those companies, generating, you know, global markets and global opportunities that bring revenue back to the university.
And have you got an example of that? You're working on?
I can give you a great example from previous life, actually. Yep. So I was the CEO of the Data to Decisions Cooperative Research Centre. So we were focused on AI-enabled capabilities in defence, intelligence, and law enforcement. And so a lot of it was around use of data to inform intelligence and law enforcement communities around, you know, terrorist activities, et cetera. We actually spun out a company called Fivecast.
Right. Yes.
Fivecast is now about 120 people, just closed a $30 million raise. You know, offices in Adelaide, where most of the dev occurs, in Washington, in London, et cetera. So that's an example where drawing on the deep tech expertise in AI, data processing, et cetera.
So just so I understand, what do they do? Like what sort of product are they providing then for law enforcement officers anti-terrorist groups?
It's basically about risk profiling of people of interest. So how do you develop a understanding of who is a risky person, a person of interest, to inform the intelligence agencies or the law enforcement agencies that this is a person we need to investigate further? And so what you do is you bring in lots and lots of data to build that richer picture of that person. And you use techniques like computer vision techniques to understand, well, from these sorts of images, here's the areas of concern, right? You use what's called natural language processing. So you understand what they've been talking about and what they've been quoting, et cetera, to inform whether they're engaging in that sort of dialogue that might mean that they're a risky person. Mm-hmm. So that's known as open source intelligence, because you derive it from open source, and then it's risk profiling. You're building that picture of a person of interest. And so doing that at scale in an automated way to then support the investigators to rather than having to manually trawl through all this data, you can surface up who's of interest and present it to an investigator and say, well, here's the 2-3 people you really got to keep an eye on. And that's
so brilliant. just using that example, which is an Australian and initiative, you said there's a capital raise. They raised 30 million.
Just closed a 30 million round A. Yeah.
Was that money locally sourced or did we have to go offshore to get
it?
A
bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. So initial investor was Main Sequence with the South Australian Venture Capital Fund. So that was the first part of that round. And then they had to go to US to get the
Because that's often the challenge. Mm-hmm. And we've talked previously about in other areas around, commercialisation record that Australia has. Mm. Part of the challenge is actually having the patient capital to invest into some of these longer term projects. Mm. And invariably, I think we were talking to Ian Fraser at one point and others, we've had to go offshore to actually attract the funding. So it's good to see there's a bit of a mix with that one. Mm. And do you think with the Defence Trailblazer, which I know we'll get to in a bit more detail, you will see more of those sort of spin-outs from the Trailblazer?
That's certainly our intent. So just we have actually just kicked off a program which is called a Defence 10X Accelerator. So it's basically we're investing in 5 local startup companies, some of which have been born out of the universities. We're cutting a first check for them for $350,000. And that's a combination of our funding as well as a group of investors as well. And the aim is really to try and grow and incubate them and get them to the point where they become VC ready, right? Yeah. And we've been having conversations with a lot of VCs who are increasingly more...
VCs being venture capitalists, not vice chancellors.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Although they could have deep pockets.
And in fact, some universities are creating their own funds as
they
well.
Are.
Yeah. And so part of it is about how do you it's a stage process. So you have to try and grow and incubate these companies, test their ideas out. So we're helping them test these ideas out with defence end users. And get them to a point where a venture capitalist will come in and go, well, actually, that's got real potential. Mm. I'm going to put my money into
that. Just on the Defence Trailblazer, it's supported by Adelaide University and UNSW Sydney. Were they chosen because they have a lead in AI and quantum computing?
Yeah, so I guess the two universities came together, and this is pre-my time, they came together to form the bid. To some degree, based on my experience working with universities, they're probably the two leading universities when it comes to defence-related research. So I often say it was a bit of a no-brainer that this particular proposal got up because University of Adelaide and UNSW are by far, I think, the leaders when it comes to defence research. And the good thing is there's quite good complementarity between the two. So if I pick AI, for example, the AI research at University of Adelaide, as I mentioned before, a lot of it is focused on that computer vision, image processing, that sort of area. If I go to UNSW, a lot of it is focused on the application of AI to areas like autonomy and robotics, et cetera. So within each of our thematic areas, there's nice complementarity between the two universities, and I think that made for a nice marriage between the two unis.
Yeah. I mean, Sanjay is right. UNSW and Adelaide out of the Group of Eight and nationally would be the heavy lifters, and across the Group of Eight, and we've talked about this previously, we're big in research broadly, but we receive almost half of defence-related research funding to the 8 universities in Australia. We also receive a significant proportion, about 80% of all funding from US defence funding through DARPA. So there's been a lot, and this hasn't just happened because we've just decided we're going to do something around submarines.
Yeah.
it's a slow burn that the universities have been engaged in for decades, really, particularly University of Adelaide here in South Australia. The other really important point, I think, with the Defence Trailblazer, which I'd be interested for you to talk to, is there's skin in the game from the universities, government, and importantly, small and medium enterprises, which is very significant given that that 90% or more than of our industrial land base in Australia are SMEs. Mm. So we often talk about the big players, the Saabs, the BAEs, mm-hmm. the Thales, Naval. Maybe we're not talking about them right now. But we forget that there is a whole kind of supply chain. Mm. So maybe just talk to a bit about how that's all come together and the opportunities there.
Sure, sure. So you're absolutely correct in that a lot of our industry partners are SMEs. So about almost 80% of our industry yeah. partners are SMEs. And they're actually putting real dollars, you know, from their bottom line on the table with the hope that they then get, you know, this IP mm-hmm. from the universities that can help further their products and take it to market and importantly address real defence problems that are being articulated through our defence partners as well. And I made the comment earlier that, you know, they're IP hungry. You know, SMEs and startups, they live and breathe by the IP that sits within their product. So for them, the ability to tap into the university sector to generate, you know, IP that will enhance their products and importantly help them address a real critical defence need, thereby opening up a market pathway for them, is absolutely critical mm-hmm. to their growth and so forth. So I've been really happy with how they really leaned into the sorts of projects and activities we're establishing. And we're very industry driven in the way that we're scoping our project. So industry is coming to us with, here's our product, here's what we're looking to do. We then help them understand, well, what's the defence need? How do you might pivot your product to meet that defence need? And then how might the universities be able to enhance your product to help you meet those defence needs. So it's been so far, I mean, we're early days still, but so far it's been great and they've been really leaning in. But, you know, it is the SMEs that are really, you know, leaning in hardest.
Because one of the big issues that we've often confronted with on the debate GO8 podcast series has been this notion of commercialising research. Mm. And it's the harder, and Australia doesn't seem to have a great track record. Mm. So how does the Defence Trailblazer assist a small SME to commercialise its idea and target it specifically to, you know, a willing buyer in the defence sector?
Yeah, so I guess we're trying to address that agenda in two ways. So one is through the actual doing. So it's the actual way in which we're structuring our R&D projects. And I often use the analogy, use an iPhone as a visual analogy, but, you know, industry is coming to us with quite a mature product. So we're operating at what they call high TRL with most of our projects.
Technological readiness level.
Right. That's correct.
So I'll just be the interpreter of
that. That's right. So it's quite mature products or solutions, you know, tested in the lab, et cetera. Yep. They're coming to us with that. We're then helping them to connect with defence to say, well, okay, that product's great, but if it had this, it would really meet a defence need. And then what we then do is we then work with the university and the industry partners to say, okay, let's scope a project that meets that need, that gap in the need, the capability gap. And that we fund that project, right? And it's a co-funding model.
Are you using PhDs to support that?
No, we're a combination of. So we're recruiting in postdoc researchers, mm-hmm. PhDs. We're also funding people within industry and equipment within industry. So as an example, we've got a couple of projects where it is, you know, largely towards the manufacturing side of things, right? So the research is a important part, but a lot of it is about actually turning that prototype into a real product. So it's the manufacturing bit. And so we're helping to fund equipment purchases, you know, through the Trailblazer program. Syro's bought a whole bunch of equipment to be used to help manufacture these sorts of products as well. So that's part of how we're helping to address that. The other bit, which is, I guess, the slower burn, but the important bit, is how do we drive the institutional reform within the university sector so that working academics are rewarded, recognised and incentivised to actually work with industry, and that becomes the norm.
Are you saying they're not currently?
Well, I think that's part of the challenge we have in Australia.
That's really interesting because it is the huge challenge about incentivising. And if you look at other countries, particularly Nordic countries, there's a greater movement between industry and universities of PhD mm-hmm. Qualified people in those areas, whereas we don't tend to have that. So how are you doing that?
So that's one example. So we have industry PhD programs. Yeah. So we're funding, we're putting 50K for a stipend, partly funded by industry, partly funded by us. But importantly, it's industry shaping the project. Mm. So it's an industry problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the PhD student working with industry in their premises. So they start to learn the language of industry. They start to understand industry's problems. They start to understand how industry works.
Mm-hmm.
And so that helps bridge that gap. We're doing that also with, you know.
They begin to understand how industry can access funds and you know, they start to think along the same lines.
Exactly. Yep.
And so, industry actually then understands also how they work.
Exactly.
Like it's a two-way thing.
So that's one of the ways in which we're trying to do it. We're trying to do it through at sort of lower levels through internships and honours students, et cetera. So that's sort of a real practical, pragmatic way of doing it. I guess the big change, though, is all about the policy process systems, right? How do we change that reward, recognition, incentive scheme? So the way—
That's a tougher one.
And that's a tougher one. But the way that these trailblazers are set up, and certainly the way we're set up, is we're a sandpit, right? So we will pilot some of these changes required within the sandpit of Defence Trailblazer. And if they prove to be successful, they may or may not be, but if they changes are successful, then we'll propose it to our two universities. And then it's up to the universities to adopt it or not. In a similar vein, the other trailblazers, so there are five others, will do it with their universities. And then hopefully you get the sort of coalition of the willing changing the broader system. So that's, I guess, the rationale for why the broader trailblazer program was established.
So without getting into too much detail, but I think it's important, my question is around the supervision of the PhD. So a PhD will have a supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, that will be an academic supervisor. I'm assuming that, is there an industry supervisor as well? Like, can you have a joint industry and academic supervisor? So you maintain the academic integrity of the PhD, because that's the point, but you have some of the real life experience of the industry supervisor as well.
And that's exactly the way we're structuring it. So it's a dual supervisor model with industry and academia there.
Well, one of the things I could imagine this, you know, having a big impact on is cybersecurity, because, you know, when you're looking at SMEs, you know, concerned about, you know, cyber issues more generally, and having a PhD student who can look at, you know, particular industries, et cetera, it seems to me, and we're seeing more and more that cyber is, you know, touching upon defence, and it's not just nation states, it's kind of individuals that can cause chaos. So tell us about Defence Trailblazer and how it's working in the cybersecurity space.
Yeah, so certainly one of the areas we're looking at is how do we upskill SMEs to understand the cyber threats they're involved, will be involved in, subject to, particularly when they start to work in defence. So there's a big body of work that we'll be doing under our workforce program about upskilling our SME community in particular and helping them navigate the additional layers that are required when you're working in defence. So there's a whole bunch of other additional requirements working in defence as well. So that's one aspect of what we are doing. I guess the other aspect of what we are doing, and in fact it's quite topical, we had a workshop this week with industry partners, defence folks, some of the other national security agencies I won't name, to really talk about what are some of the challenges out there that we're having to deal with. And the university sector is you know, a soft underbelly, right? People target the university sector because they know they can exfiltrate, they can extract, you know, IP and, you know, and really valuable knowledge. And so we, part of our challenge is how do we raise the awareness of people working on our projects? How do we build the systems and processes to make sure that, you know, we have a good handle on who's, you know, how people are working, et cetera. If we do need to go into the classified domain with our projects, then we have to work within our defence partners and our industry partners who already have those facilities set up. The university doesn't, you know, university's got it set up to work at those really classified levels. So we'll work in with our industry partners and defence partners. So it's a multi-tiered approach we have to take with this. But I think the first thing is raising awareness. Like, people don't recognise just how much of a ongoing, all-pervasive threat it is at the moment. And as you say, it's not just about the nation state actors. It's about, you know, people sitting in the lounge room with a laptop being able to, you know, hack into networks and take out information and then sell that on the dark web and, you know, those sorts of things.
One of my other roles is I'm a founding member of the University Foreign Interference Task Force.
Right.
And we've been doing a lot of work really over the last 4 to 5 years of just awareness and building resilience in our own systems, because universities are absolute targets for a whole lot of reasons. The other issue, which is quite topical that you talked about, is at the moment, and I note that of the five, I think, themes of the Defence Trailblazer, many align with AUKUS Pillar 2.
That's correct.
Particularly around hypersonics and artificial intelligence and quantum. One of the barriers that's been identified in the development of AUKUS Pillar 2 and AUKUS more generally is we've got the UK, the US and Australia in terms of movement of research teams. I think I certainly had this discussion in the UK. UK and Australia probably a little bit easier, and there is actually a live discussion going on in the US Congress now around their defence export controls, if you like. Mm. It's called something else, but that's what...
ITARS.
ITARS, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering, because that is a barrier to research collaboration, and all good research is global, it's not local. Mm. So within the Defence Trailblazer, is there opportunity, and has there been opportunity for defence research teams to work across the three domains? And what do you see as some of the challenges to that?
Yeah, so certainly that is our intent. So at the moment, all of our projects are done locally mm-hmm. within Australia, but part of our intent is actually to explore international opportunities, both for the research but also for the commercial opportunities that come out of the research. So, and that is a definite challenge in defence. So just to give everyone, a feel for how much of a challenge it can be, so we have global primes that are involved who have a US base and they have an Australian base. It's very difficult for those primes to share technologies and IP from their US parent company with their Australian parent company, because it gets slapped with this ITARS mm. sticker on top of it. So International Trade in Arms Regulation. And then that then limits who can work on the projects, what you can do with the IP, where you can sell it, etc. So often what we are having discussions is, well, how do we replicate some of those technologies in that are in US ITAR control capabilities in Australia, so that we can then more readily service Australian defence needs. Mm-hmm. So you're almost running a parallel project, right? So in order for AUKUS Pillar 2 to be successful, that has to be addressed, right? There will not be free and easy technology transfer unless you're addressing that. And certainly at the political level, there's discussions going on at the most senior levels. But it's when you get to those layers down that's where the barriers come up, because a desk officer, you know, isn't really willing to sort of sign the document that says, okay, I'm going to transfer these technologies, because they don't know what the impact is going to be. So I do think it's a real major challenge that needs to be addressed. It is something people are acutely aware of, but it is something that needs to be addressed. There are some technology transfer mechanisms available, particularly in defence, that have worked well over the years. So there's one called TTCP. So I won't expand the acronym because I can't remember it fully, but it's led by, in Australia, it's led by Defence Science Technology Group, DSTG, and their counterparts in other Five Eyes countries, so Australia, UK, US, New Zealand and Canada. And so that allows for transfer under certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. But even with TTCP, there's often instances where they'll have to exclude people from Australia because mm-hmm. it's US eyes only, et cetera, mm-hmm. and things like that. So I think that's going to be the area that has to be addressed to enable AUKUS to be really successful.
And that's certainly the work that at the Group of Eight we're doing, working really closely with our security agencies, working with the US, our US counterparts and our UK counterparts, to try and break that sort of policy barrier. Mm. Because another pillar of AUKUS Pillar 2 is actually information sharing as
That's
well.
Correct.
But it's very hard to share the information when there's such strong barriers.
Time's against us, so I just want to ask one last question, though. Sure. We've talked about cybersecurity, we've talked about defence, we've talked about SMEs and the work that they do. But do you think through the work that Defence Trailblazer does in the years ahead that there will be spin-offs that impact on our everyday lives, you know, as opposed to defence and cyber? You know, do you think there'll be other things that come from some of this research that we have yet to contemplate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have a strong focus on what we call dual use. So, yes, we're addressing a defence-related problem, but how does it have potential and opportunities in other sectors as well? And defence has traditionally, you know, been the genesis of technology for solving problems in other sectors, whether it be health or agriculture. And I think just to try and make it real, as an example, one of the areas we will be exploring is around space-based surveillance of what's going on on ground. So using satellite technology and imagery to work out, you know, what's that build-up of capability over there, what's happening over here. So geospatial intelligence, space-based surveillance. So that has a definite defence application. But if you think about things like, you know, managing bushfires, right, there's a spin-off application. You think about agriculture.
I can imagine water flows down the Murray.
That's right.
You know, so, having sensors that tell you where the water's going.
That's correct. Yeah. And, you know, looking at trying to detect salinity levels in the Murray, you know, so you don't get dead fish in the Murray-Darley Basin.
Mm. Yeah.
So you can use satellite imagery to do that as well, and then use the sort of computer vision techniques I spoke about earlier to detect what's going on. Space-based agriculture, looking at, you know, how the crops and things like that to inform irrigation. So there's huge potential for those dual-use applications through what we do in defence. And certainly for a lot of our industry partners, they can't put all their eggs in the defence basket. You know, defence will buy 5, 6, 10 of those, you know, solutions, whereas agriculture might buy, you know, hundreds of them.
It's so exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, they look at multiple sectors.
Well, maybe that's a much more positive place to leave it rather than what we've been talking about with war and defence. But Dr. Sanjay Mazumdar, thank you very much for your time today. It sounds like fascinating work in the years ahead.
Great.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you both.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune in to The Debate at Go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.